This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 71 was recorded on July 13th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend, Salient Partners chief investment strategist and author of the immensely popular Epsilon Theory blog. Dr. Ben Hunt will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss why Ben says the Fed is no longer your friend and why he thinks a sea change is upon us for asset markets. But wait, there's more. After the feature interview, macro tourist author Kevin Muir will be joining Patrick and I in our post-game segment, where we'll be discussing the mechanics of ETFs, the Canadian and Australian housing markets, and much more.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 blasted off once Janet Yellen started speaking and has just not even looked back. We're up pretty much almost 40 S&P points in a couple of days. What's your thinking here on the S&P?
Well, you know, I think that what we're seeing is kind of what I expected when we talked about this last week. We were hovering right on the 50-day moving average, finding support there, not breaking through it. And what I see here is a very nice, healthy-looking bounce off the 50-day moving average. Very favorable response, obviously, to Yellen's Humphrey Hawkins testimony before Congress. Ben Hunt says this too shall pass, and I agree with Ben Hunt's view that you're going to hear later in the program, which is that in the grand scheme of things, you know, we are going to see a sea change where eventually the Fed will be unwinding its balance sheet and so forth. But exactly how that plays out, you know, I'm still on the fence about whether the top is in this market, or I think it's probably a little more likely that we have one last summer rally that maybe takes us to all-time new highs sometime in the end of this month or into August. And I think then later in the year, it would make more sense to see things start to fall apart. But I would also say there's too many people that are holding that view. There are so many people saying, okay, October of 2017, that's going to be the big one. Generally, if there's one time when markets never crash, it's when everybody's predicting them to crash. And that's not just an irony. That really is a cause and effect mechanism, which is that when institutional investors have laid on a lot of hedges and everybody's got protection against the downside, no panic ever occurs because they don't need to panic because they've got that protection in place, and the dramatic sell-off never really happens. So, you know, it's hard to say where this is going to play out, but I don't think there's any reason to think that it's all over in the top. Is in. I think anything could happen from this point.
And when we move on to that dollar index, it's more or less still hovering in a very flat range around that 95 handle. It looks like the euro just keeps bouncing back and forth. You think this is it for the dollar index, or you think there's a little more weakness still to come?
Well, I don't know. I've been debating that all week, Patrick. You know, you could make an argument that it seems like we're finding a base right around 95. We're trading on a mid-95 handle as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. It's been in the 95 range for the last week or so. So maybe what we're seeing is that a support level is forming here, and that's going to be it. I've kind of been thinking that maybe a further decay down to 92 or so might be in the cards. That's just a hunch. It's not really based on any strong conviction. My general view, though, is I haven't really heard the argument from anyone that says, okay, look, here's why the whole secular bull argument for the U.S. dollar is wrong. Here's why that 102 high that we saw was going to be the high for a long time. Here's why we're going to see a secular trend reversal, and it's going to be a bear market for the next 3 years for the dollar index. I guess Mark Yusko gave us a view along those lines. I want to go back and listen to that again. But aside from Mark, I can't think of anyone who's really expressed that view. I'm looking for it because I'd like to understand the argument. So far, the way I see it is we should see a return to a secular bull trend in the U.S. dollar as soon as this whole euro strength situation kind of fades out. We'll see what happens.
All right. Well, let's move on to your favorite topic, and let's discuss crude oil. And really, we had that intense selling throughout the month of June. But since then, more or less, we've been in a consolidation pattern. It doesn't seem that the bulls can really make anything stick. But at the same time, you know, the sellers really haven't resumed any heavy selling. What do you think about all this chop here?
Well, it's fascinating tape action. We saw a big pop on Tuesday afternoon, which is when API, which is the American Petroleum Institute, the private survey that precedes the official government inventory report, API reported massive drawdowns on crude oil inventory, upwards of 8 million barrels. And that was against a consensus expectation of 2.5 million barrels. Then DOE on Wednesday morning confirmed that essentially. They actually came in at an official drawdown number of 7.6 million barrels of crude oil removed from inventory in the last week. Now, that's a really, really huge number, especially when consensus expectations were more like 2 million. 1.9 million coming out of Cushing, Oklahoma. Gasoline drawing down 1.6 million. Pretty good build in distillate inventories, adding 3.1 million. But I think probably the most important part of the news is the part of the data release that I think is most important is the part that most people didn't really pay attention to, and that is that we ticked up to a cycle high in domestic oil production. So we're continuing to produce more and more oil. Now, it's true at the same time that we're also exporting more oil, but again, in terms of world inventories, even if it gets exported, you know, how much is being produced and how much is being used, we still have a supply glut here. So last week, I cracked a joke on the program that after we saw what should have been an extremely bullish signal coming from inventory with that big drawdown last week, and I made the joke that the spike upside in prices only lasted for an hour or so. Well, this week, we got a much more bullish report, and the upside spike in prices lasted less than 1 minute. In fact, 30 minutes after the data came out, we were more than $1 to the downside. So why the heck, after you have this massive drawdown on inventory, do you see such a huge sell-off? And my initial reaction to that was, okay, it had already been priced in reaction to the API private survey. The market had pushed itself up almost to its 50-day moving average. We pushed up to a channel resistance line that's been in play since the end of May. I think the high print was around 46 spot 45 or so. Very quickly retraced down from that, selling off very hard on Wednesday afternoon. But boy, on Thursday, we went right back up almost to the same level that we were before the data came out. And there wasn't really any particular news to drive that. So I think that the buying is exhausted here and that resistance line is going to hold, but you know, it remains to be seen. We're still below the 50-day moving average, which is at about 46 spot 60. I think if we stay below it, that my view continues to be bearish. And again, this should have been a super bullish inventory report, but the thing is that it's a reaction to the weather event that we had with the tropical storm a couple of weeks ago. I don't think it's going to last. Now, Sam Madani did have a couple of tweets out pointing out that the SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve selling that the government has been doing, it has pretty much reached its quota for this year. So if they're not going to do any more SPR sales, that could be another bullish factor that comes into this market. We'll see whether or not that plays out. But in general, the way that I'm looking at this is I think that the buying has pretty much run out of steam here and that we're probably going to roll over to the downside. If we see a decisive move above 46 spot 60, which is the 50-day moving average, then I would change my view and say, okay, something else is in the works here.
Thanks for that update. Now, when we move on to gold, there's no better way to define gold than a very distinct sell cycle distribution through the entire month of June that basically saw it wipe out almost down to 1,200 on the downside. You would think here in early July that it would be able to muster up at least a half-decent Fibonacci retracement or something back to the upside, but it seems every time gold gets an uptick, it's just met with distribution. It's almost like there's no interest to take it higher. What's your take on where gold is here?
Well, I agree with everything you just said. What you left out, though, is all of this is happening as the dollar is performing very weakly. That ought to be giving a tailwind to gold. So you'd expect a really nice, healthy bounce here, even if the bearish move was going to continue. You'd expect to see a better bounce than we've seen, and we haven't seen it. So we've gotten a little bit of a bounce off of a 1204 low on Sunday night. I think the high print so far has been 1225 or so, and we're back down into the 1218 range on Thursday afternoon. The pattern remains, though, of lower lows and lower highs. We're below both the 50 and 200-day moving average and have been below both of them for several weeks now. So all of this, to me, portends a bearish outlook for gold in the weeks to come.
Now, Eric, I wanted to move on to the Treasury bonds, in particular the 10-year. And before we talk about the levels, it was a really interesting story that was highlighted on Zero Hedge, which was talking about that some big trader came in there and literally opened a $10 million, like 60,000 contract position of a strangle, buying calls and puts on the 10-year Treasury yield, anticipating just in the next like 8 days between now and the July 21st expiration for there to be an explosive move. And obviously, it doesn't matter which direction, higher or lower, but certainly a very big bet on that. It's interesting because we've already seen some volatility. We whipped from 240 down to almost to the 230 at the bottom end range. We're trading right now about to 235 yield. What's your feeling here about what's next in Treasury yields?
Yeah, it's hard to tell when you see something like that. You know, obviously, Janet Yellen's Humphrey Hawkins speech could have caused somebody to think that there was going to be a move one way or the other. A $10 million strangle, 65,000 contracts sounds like a huge, huge bet to you and me. There are really big macro funds where that's just a tiny little lottery ticket that somebody might have bought just to see what happened out of curiosity. So, you know, it's really hard to put a lot of meaning into that, but I do think it's interesting that people are looking at this situation and saying, boy, what Janet says next could really drive the direction of this. The range seems to be 2.12 on the low side to 2.40-something. I think 43 or 44 is what the technicians are saying is kind of where the top is in this trading range. And we've tested both ends of that. It's going to be interesting to see which end we break out on. I'm still leaning lower yields that we'll see below 2.12, and that'll open the door to accelerate the drop down to 2%. I could be wrong. If we see a move north of 2.45, that would suggest maybe Jeff Gundluck is right after all. We still can't get him to come on the program. We've been working on that. Maybe we'll get somebody else from Double Line to come and give us an update.
Well, thanks for the update, Eric. So back to join us again as this week's featured interview guest is Dr. Ben Hunt, investment strategist at Salient Partners and the author of the Epsilon Theory blog. Eric's interview with Dr. Hunt is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Dr. Ben Hunt, Chief Investment Strategist at Salient Partners. Ben, thanks so much for coming back on the program. I think it's been almost a year since we had you on. Ben, I think that you are probably as well known for the Epsilon Theory blog as you are for your work at Salient Partners. And you recently penned a very interesting piece where you see a sea change coming in terms of markets. So please give us the rundown. We've got a link in our Research Roundup email for people who may be interested in reading that full piece, which is titled Tell My Horse. Why the title and what is that piece about?
Well, thanks for having me back on, Eric. It's really a pleasure to be back on the podcast here. You're right. I have been writing for about 4 years now on the blog Epsilon Theory. And in the most recent article, it ended up, it's been the most well-received article I've put out there on the blog to date. And it is about a sea change that I think is happening. You know, I wrote this about 3 weeks ago before I think a lot of other people have kind of picked up on the same thing. But the sea change is simply this, that central banks, particularly our Federal Reserve, are changing course. They're changing, to use the $10 phrase that economists use, their reaction function. And all that means is that they're now interpreting the world and looking for reasons to tighten rather than seeing the world and looking for reasons to ease on monetary policy. So they're taking away the punch bowl, and this is not just the case in the U.S., where this process has been building and acting for some time now, but it is also starting in Europe, and even in Japan, which has been the most active accommodationist central bank out there for the last couple of years. Even in Japan, you know, they're talking about how to start tapering or changing their policy. Because here's the thing: what the Fed means by taking away the punch bowl is not just the traditional approach of raising interest rates. That's the traditional tool that the Fed has. You cut interest rates when times are tough, and you raise interest rates when you're concerned about inflation or you think you're at full employment or the like. Well, the Fed's doing all that. I mean, we've now raised rates in three quarters, three successive quarters, and they're signaling they're going to do it again at some point this year. But more than that, more than simply raising rates, what the Fed is also doing is they're starting to shrink the balance sheet that they've grown over the last 8 years. They're starting to roll off. They're starting to reduce the balance sheet that was at the core of the extraordinary measures that our central bank and other central banks have employed over the last 8 years to try to juice the global economy. But more importantly than that, they've juiced financial assets. So when we're talking about a sea change, when we're talking about the Fed tightening rather than easing, it is different this time. It's different this time because their tightening includes reducing a balance sheet that they've never grown before. So it's easy to say, well, you know, it'll be about as exciting as watching paint dry. That was some of the comments that people have made, and it's not a big deal. Well, you know, it is a big deal because the at least the risk here for markets that we will see in reverse the impact, a negative impact on markets as they shrink the balance sheet in the same way that we saw a very positive impact on markets as they expanded the balance sheet. You can't have it both ways is what I'm saying, is that if you thought it was great for markets when they were buying everything in sight, and we can talk about why they did it and how they did it and how that impacted markets, then you also have to admit that if they're now going to shrink that balance sheet, that's a big change. And I'll finish up this kind of introduction with a comment that the Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan made the other day, which I thought was really apt. He was saying, look, for the last 8 years, the tide's been coming in, meaning that the Fed, central banks around the world have been easing on the interest rate. They've been buying stuff to expand their balance sheet. And he said, and now the tide's going out. And that's just a different environment that we all have to cope with when we're thinking about our investments and achieving our investment goals.
Now, I think one of the most interesting lines that you used in that article, you made a comment about, you know, financial markets, you've got to get it through your head. Janet Yellen just broke up with you, and it's going to be a different game going forward. I really relate to that, and I think it's very insightful. But at the same time, we taped this particular interview on Wednesday morning, July 12th, and as we're speaking, Janet Yellen is also giving her Humphrey Honkins testimony before Congress. And there was about a 20-point run-up in the S&P ahead of that, very much to my surprise. There was also, I think the Dow actually hit a new all-time high minutes before Janet started speaking. So it seems like the market thinks that Janet has suddenly changed her stance and turned dramatically more dovish. Does that cause any concern for your outlook? You know, do you think that Janet
is having remorse
about...
No, look. See, what we're thinking about now, think about why the market reacted so positively this morning to Yellen saying, yeah, we're going to raise interest rates. The barge is still moving in the direction of tightening, but she didn't give any specifics about, well, when we're going to start reducing the balance sheet, and she didn't give any specifics about, well, when we're going to raise interest rates again. And of course she doesn't give specifics, right? You know, you never give specifics in a testimony or written statement before you're going to answer questions from Congress. That's just something you never do. But what I'm saying is, think about the analysis here. What we're thinking about is, all right, we know she's tightening, but is she going to be really aggressive in the tightening or less aggressive in the tightening? That's the debate we're having in the narrative of markets today. Now, compare that to 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. There the debate was, all right, Janet Yellen is going to be easing. Is she going to be more aggressive or less aggressive in her easing? This is what I mean about a sea change, right? The whole notion of the argument is now focused on, all right, is she going to be really, really tightening or just tightening a little bit, right? It's about the pace of tightening, not whether tightening is occurring or not. The argument is no longer about if the Fed is going to start reducing their balance sheet. Now the argument is when the Fed is going to reduce their balance sheet. So yeah, we're going to see these ups and downs. This is a very slow burn. This isn't some big bubble that gets popped, you know, tomorrow. What I'm saying is that in the same way that we had a tailwind for markets, where the Fed was our best friend for the last 8 years, they're no longer our friend. Right, they're no longer our friend because their job is not to prop up markets. Their job is price stability, right, inflation, and to manage full employment. And what the Fed thinks right now, whether we think it or not, the Fed thinks they've hit full employment. And the Fed thinks that inflation is around the corner. And I'll tell you, when you look at the world and when you look at the U.S., look, inflation is picking up. It just is. And so that's why the Fed is going to start and continue to be on this tightening path. The Fed is a barge, right? It's not a speedboat. It's an absolute barge. But when the barge turns around, when it starts going, I don't know whether we call it upstream or downstream, but when it starts going in the opposite direction for where it's been going over the last 8 years, there's nothing more important, I think, for an investor than to understand that shift. Because think of this too, right? What's been moving the markets over not just the past, not today, not just the past week, not just the past month, not just the past year, but what's been moving the market over the 8 years? Is it fundamentals? Is it this sector or that sector or this company or that sector? No. It's been all Fed, all central bank, all the time. And that's no different today. So we're going to get ups and we're going to get downs. What I'm saying is that the barge is now moving in a different direction. And so our overall planning for what we can expect from the market going forward is different from our planning from what we've been able to expect from the market over the last 8 years.
So we're right at high tide, or just a few minutes after high tide, except that in a real tidal cycle on the ocean, it's a 12-hour cycle. It's been 8 years that the tide's been coming in. Let's talk about what the flowing tide looks like, or what the picture is going to look like for investors as the tide starts to flow back out. Because as you said, it's not just about tightening in the sense of raising interest rates, which is where everybody seems to focus. It's also about the reversal of this balance sheet expansion. It's something that I've found fascinating is so many people seem to be hypnotized by what I think is a very false argument, which is, well, you see, the Fed is not going to be selling off all of those treasuries. It's just going to hold them until maturity. And of course, that ignores the fact that if you're holding them until maturity and not rolling them forward, you're eliminating all the buying that's been in the system when the Fed was rolling those securities forward. So if they're going to stop rolling them forward, it really is equivalent to selling, I think. Am I missing something there?
Oh,
and what?
No, you're so right, because it's the absence of buying is an enormous impact. So think of it this way. So the our Federal Reserve today has got, call it a $4 trillion balance sheet, right? They've got $4 trillion worth of stuff. And these are U.S. Treasuries and Fannie and Freddie backed mortgage-backed securities. Now, okay, on that $4 trillion worth of bonds that they owned, or mortgage-backed securities they owned, yeah, the average tenor, the average lifespan, right, until they run out of these notes is, I don't know, let's call it 6 or 7 years, right? Whatever the exact number is. Well, what that means is that, and it's pretty evenly distributed over that span. And what that means is then that we've got hundreds of billions of dollars. I think the number is something like $800 billion worth of bonds, right, that are going to roll off, call it over the next 2 years, right? So what we haven't been expanding the balance sheet since the summer of 2014, when our tapering stopped. So in the summer of 2014, the U.S. Fed stopped expanding the balance sheet. But they didn't stop buying. To your point, Eric, they didn't stop buying. Because as those bonds rolled off, meaning that they reached maturity, the Fed would take the proceeds from those bonds and they'd buy new bonds. They'd buy more bonds. So absolutely, when you're talking about allowing the balance sheet to roll off, it means the Fed is no longer going to be in the market to the tune of, call it, $400 or $500 billion a year of buying stuff as they have been over the last couple of years. So just because the balance sheet isn't expanding doesn't mean they're not out in the market buying. And so the removal of this buyer, this massive buyer, and we're not even talking about all the other central banks who are buying even more than that, right? And not just buying bonds, but in the case of, for example, the Bank of Japan directly buying ETFs, equity ETFs on the Tokyo Exchange, in the case of the Swiss National Bank directly buying equities, right? Apple. It's crazy, right? But this is what's going on. It's the absence of these massive buyers is going to have a major impact on markets, right? You can't take away It's basic supply and demand. It's basically the basic information of how prices work. When you take away a big buyer, it's harder for prices to go up, and it's a lot easier for prices to go down.
Well, it seems to me, too, that there is plenty of opportunity for people to misinterpret signals here, because let's suppose, for example, that what they stop buying is longer-dated treasuries, and that causes the yield to go up on those longer-dated treasuries. Now everybody starts jumping for joy. Steepening yield curve. The economy must be super strong right now. Well, no, it's not steepening for that reason. It's steepening because this buyer just disappeared. So where do you think, in terms of maturity, the buying is going to go away? And what will it mean for the bond market and the shape of the yield curve? And you know, where is the play there? If you were a fixed income investor, where do you get scared when this buying goes away?
Here's the thing. There's really no place to hide, right? So, but let me put it this way. So the goal here, the goal here is to be unwinding this balance sheet and to have provided enough of a bridge so that the actual real economy starts to grow as well. Because your point's exactly right. Look, if the interest rate on a longer-term bond goes up, meaning the price has gone down, right? Why is it going up? Right, and this is your point, right? It could be going up for a good reason, right? Maybe it's the price of money over a longer period of time. Maybe the rate of return I'm requiring on this to lend you money over a longer period of time is going up. Maybe this interest rate is going up because, hey, we've got some actual real economic growth here in this country. To put my money to work or to lock it up for a longer period of time, given these growth opportunities, I need a higher rate of interest in return. That's a good reason for rates to be going up. Exactly to your point, that's that steepening yield curve for a good reason. But if you're just getting the steepening yield curve because the Fed is no longer buying, i.e. artificially pumping up the price and depressing the yield of these longer dated bonds, well, that's a bad reason for these rates to be going up, right? And that's exactly the point you're making, Eric, and that's exactly the balancing act here. Now, look, the market, and here I'm anthropomorphizing a bit, but look, the market wants to buy. They want to believe a happy story. So, yes, banks are going to rally pretty much regardless of why the yield curve is steepening, and we've seen this. Right? There will be enough going on that you will have no shortage of arguments being made that, okay, they're going to do it, meaning shrink the balance sheet. Yeah, it'll take out a lot of the froth in markets, but we'll be able to bridge this gap that the rates will start going up for good reasons, not just because the Fed is selling or no longer buying, but for the good economic reasons of real economic growth kicking back in. And listen, I hope they're right. I mean, I don't like saying that the tide's going out and that we've got to be very concerned about the valuations and the risk that's in markets, particularly equity markets. I don't like that, but I think we have to be realistic about it. And what I'm saying is that if you thought that our current valuations and prices, particularly in equities, was at least in large part driven by central banks buying $14 trillion worth of stuff over the last 8 years, you have to be concerned about those valuations and those price levels if now these central banks are looking to get out. That's all I'm saying here. I hope they're right that it's a bridge to real economic growth that makes interest rates go up for the right reasons. But gosh, when you look around the world, it's really hard to see that, right?
Now, historically, when we think about what happens in equity markets in normal economic cycles, there's the old saying that stock prices tend to ride up an escalator and down the express elevator as things fall apart all suddenly at once. But obviously, the Fed is not going to liquidate its entire balance sheet suddenly all at once. So when we talk about this changing tide or changing sea, is it a setup for a crash in markets, or is it more of just a very, you know, shallow, boring, gradual bear market that lasts for several years that you see potentially on the horizon?
Well, great question. Here's what I think you have to look at, right? So it's never going to be the Fed that's going to immediately go out there and say, "Oh, we're selling everything," and that's just not the way they work. They do work very gradually. They are a barge, right? But what we as investors have to look for, and I think we have to be very diligent about looking for this, is where is there too much leverage in the system, right? Which companies, which sectors, which areas have a business model where they have gorged on zero interest rates, where they have gorged on this wall of money and buying and liquidity that the central banks have provided. Who's got a business model that depends, for example, on negative yielding bonds? Who's got a business model that depends on the ability to lever up whatever equity they have through enormously cheap borrowing to use that for their business operations? Right, I can give you some ideas of companies and sectors that have gorged on the excesses of this policy, and that's what we have to look for. It's the malinvestment. This is what bubbles are born of, right? And when the Federal Reserve is now popping this bubble, and they're hoping to do it as they always do, they're hoping to pop the bubble very gently, but as you're suggesting, that's a great thing to think you can do, but it's really hard to do in practice, because there are so many institutions and investors and ordinary humans that always take these things to excess. And I think that's what we as investors have to look for. The bubble is not going to come from the Fed directly. The bubble bursting is going to come from companies or sectors, and these always tend to be institutions that have in one way or another gorged on the excesses of the policies of the last 8 years.
Well, let's go ahead and talk then about some of the areas where excesses have built up and what potentially could be coming. I know there's one area in particular that you've written about recently, which I very much think very frequently about. I call it the great ETF unwind. And as you've described in some of your recent writings, ETFs were designed in part to enable passive investors to construct portfolios that are just bought and held and nobody actively trades them. And somehow, because they were designed for that purpose, people make the assumption that that's how they've been used. I don't think they've been used that way at all. I think they're used by a lot of retail traders as a way to express a lot of speculative bets. And this massive, massive influx of capital into ETFs in the last several years. I think that if there is a panic type of situation, you could see those ETFs unwinding very dramatically. Is that one of the bigger risk areas that we should look at? And if not, that's not it, feel free to suggest what other areas you're concerned with and you're looking at.
Here's the problem that I think with ETFs. So I'm less concerned about, I'll call it kind of the massive unwind and unorderly unwind of an ETF, unless you're talking about ETFs that exist where they shouldn't exist, like on, you know, illiquid stuff like, you know, a high-yield bond ETF. You know, they exist, and they're not a huge part of the market. So I don't worry so much about, you know, waking up some morning and there's been this crash, right, which we've seen before. We've seen before on these ETFs, usually some sort of pricing mechanism, and people use it. They set stop losses, and they shouldn't anyway. All of that rigmarole. But what I think is here's the larger danger that I see from the ETFs, and I think you're absolutely right to focus on ETFs as an area of engorgement, right? And what I mean by that is that ETFs are the epitome of active investing, right? They're not managed. The funds themselves are not managed actively. There's not someone there. There actually is in some of these ETFs now, but in the vast, vast majority of ETFs, there's not some manager who's picking and choosing that stock or another, right? But that doesn't mean that they are passive instruments, not at all, right? Because you, Mr. Investor, whether you're a financial advisor following the ETF model of, you know, your firm that puts one out, right? Or whether you are a retail investor and you're using this as to construct your own portfolio, or frankly, if you're an enormous institution, which is also using ETFs, right, as part and parcel of how they put together a portfolio, like a pension fund or like a foundation or endowment. You know, this isn't just a retail phenomenon, not at all. But what I'm saying is that the use of ETFs is an act of active management, right? It is part of a conscious decision. Oh, I want this sector rather than that sector. Oh, I want this geography rather than that geography. Oh, I want this asset class rather than that asset class, right? It is the epitome of active management, and it's under this rubric of, oh, I'm a passive investor. Nonsense. So your point about it feeding on itself, and this is, I think, the larger point about it feeding itself, it's not that it is, I think, structurally unsound, where it owns these illiquid things, and so people want to sell it, and the underlying securities can't be sold. That's not what I'm concerned about. What I'm concerned about is this, that when you do get a shock, and there will be a shock, because there's always someone out swimming in this ocean of liquidity who's not really wearing swimming trunks, right? And when that fraud is revealed, when that excessive leverage is revealed, when that shock occurs, and it will, then the real issue with ETFs is that because they're not passive instruments, because they are the epitome of active decision-making, the decision to sell can be rampant and can absolutely feed on itself. Not because it's part of some quant strategy like risk parity or the like. That's a boogeyman that people out there. The real boogeyman here are the financial advisors, the foundations and endowments, the pension funds, the retail investors, all of whom have chosen this ETF or that ETF because they are, quote unquote, taking charge of their own portfolios. And when they get this sort of shock, they're going to sell. And when you see the selling, that drives other active investors to sell as well. That's the feedback loop that I think we are likely to have here, because there is no circuit breaker for a financial advisor who has his clients' money in ETFs. Right? There's no circuit breaker for that. The market's down. There's been a shock. You're going to sell. And it's that sort of feeding on itself that I think is the real risk. Here's the bottom line. There's all this talk about how we've moved from active management to passive management. That's true in a very narrow sense, meaning that we're now no longer hiring these portfolio managers to make the active decision of what to buy and what to sell. But the truth is, the larger truth is that active management of portfolios has never been greater. They're just being exercised by different people. You know, not the stock picker fund manager, but by the allocator or financial advisor or retail investor or pension fund that's buying these ETFs directly. And that's the source of active management that I think can result in a really squirrely market that absolutely feeds on itself once you get some sort of shock that comes out of this, now the tide going out rather than the tide coming in.
Now, you emphasized that the problems would exist in particularly in those ETFs that never should have existed in the first place. I'd like to talk about one of those in particular, because this just blows my mind that this can be happening. But more than a year ago, I had Raul Paul on this program, and he raised a red flag about an institutional trade, something that really only institutions have the sophistication to put on, which is a lot of pensions were trying to create income by shorting VIX futures and basically exploiting the contango yield that existed there. And Raul talked about why that was an incredibly stupid idea, and I think he actually remarked in that interview, thankfully, it's something that requires enough sophistication that only the people who ought to know better are able to put it on. Well, what's happened since then is the creation of the XIV, which is the inverse VIX, and that has actually gotten to the point where its trading size is larger than the VXX, which is the not inverse VIX ETF. I saw it was actually an interaction on Twitter where one of the traders there described his experience of eating out in a restaurant, and the waitress at the restaurant is short the VIX through the XIV ETF in order to exploit that contango yield. There's this old expression, what could go wrong here? What could go wrong there, Ben? And, you know, in situations like that where we have an ETF like XIV, the people who are invested in it, I'm convinced, have absolutely no clue how it works or why that contango yield has been there. What could happen when this all starts to unwind?
Well, look, what you're describing is the prototypical notion of picking up pennies in front of a steamroller, right? Now, but let me say this, right? Wall Street is built on the idea of picking up pennies in front of a steamroller, right? So for the last 8 years, the biggest source of profits for the street has been selling volatility. It's been, I'll call it the whack-a-mole model of understanding volatility. That whenever volatility spikes up, you whack it on the head. You sell it. You sell that insurance policy. You sell it, sell it, sell it. Because when the tide is coming in, when you've got that central bank put behind you, when you've got the central banks buying $2 trillion worth of stuff every year, you want to be selling volatility. You absolutely want to be selling that insurance policy. You absolutely want to be playing the whack-a-mole game with the VIX, where, again, every time it pops up because people get nervous about this political event or that political event, you whack it on the head by selling it. That has been the absolute dominant winning strategy for hedge funds and the street alike over the last 8 years. Right? And what you always get in these kind of fin de siècle, these, you know, last gasps of a golden age, you get it expanding into the popular consciousness with something like the XIV, with something like, you know, in my case, it was an Uber driver was asking me about, you know, should he put more money into the fangs or, you know, artificial intelligence. And it's all of a course, right? So those of us, you know, like you and me, Eric, have been around the block a little while, you know, we see these things come and then we see them go. And when they go, when they break, is when the tide goes out. So, you know, there really is nothing new under the sun. This process, this of what we're seeing in terms of quote unquote financial innovation is as old as trading and markets itself. And these cycles that happen, and the cycles are always based on liquidity, the amount of money that's coming in or going forward, coming out of the system, those are the inflection points for when these things break. And that's the point I think we're at. And again, this isn't an immediate thing. It's not like tomorrow, oh my God, I think volatility is going to spike and all this stuff's going to get wiped out. But this is it's an absolute inflection point. It's a word to the wise for investors that if you've been investing on the basis of the Fed has always got your back and the Fed is your friend, that's changing now. And we need to prepare ourselves and certainly not get sucked in to the strategies that work really well when the tide's coming in, not pursue those now if the tide's coming out.
Another area where there's been a lot of excess built up is real estate. Not so much in the U.S. at this point, but a lot of people think that both Canadian and Australian real estate, residential real estate, has hit a bubble stage that some people think is even more extreme than what the United States got to around 2005, 2006. Do you agree that there's a lot of risk there? And if so, does it mean? Because, of course, U.S. real estate loans were securitized. Canadian and Australian are not securitized. So if there's a trade there, is it shorting the banks? What potentially could happen in terms of these inflated real estate markets that still exist around the world?
Well, so first of all, yes, absolutely. I think that's exactly there is a significant bubble on the housing side in both Australia and Canada. But here's what I also think. I don't know how to short that. I don't know how to short it. And I'll tell you why. So, and look, in my hedge fund, I was absolutely shorting mortgage-backed securities here in the U.S. You know, 2008 was a career year for me because of the property bubble bursting here in the States. But the problem with here's the problem with trying to set up that trade, right, in either Canada or Australia. It's almost impossible to short mortgage-backed securities via credit these days. And if you're trying to short the lenders themselves, well, unfortunately, you've got a Warren Buffett put underneath the subprime lenders, right, since he bailed out Home Capital Group, right? So and if you think about, well, maybe it's Canadian home builders or, you know, maybe it's Australian, I say, you know, lenders and the like. The problem is can you find that pure play? Can you find the market depth there to set that up as a trade? And my answer is, at least I haven't been able to find it, right? So here's the scary thing about that. Because there, and this is why short sellers are so important in any market, right? Because there's no, I haven't been able to find a way to express a short view on this bubble, that explains why that bubble persists. It allows the bubble to keep inflating. And it makes that bubble bursting, whenever it happens and however it happens, you know, maybe you know, again, with global rates rising, that can certainly put a dent in that bubble. If you get even a hiccup in terms of the real economy, in terms of even a whiff of recession, that can obviously put a pop that bubble as well. When that bubble bursts, it's going to hurt ordinary people, the homeowners, the borrowers, that much more. So, you know, I know that's a long-winded response, but it's something I feel passionately about. Yes, absolutely, I think there's a bubble. And no, I don't know how to short that bubble. And what that means is that because I can't short it, that bubble is going to get bigger, and it's going to make it more difficult on real people when it does ultimately burst.
So to summarize, it sounds like really the main point here is recognize we're just after high tide. We're so used to, and we've gotten so accustomed to, younger people in the business have only ever experienced a flood tide. Now we're about to experience an ebb tide, which none of us have recent experience with. Some people have no experience with, and it's going to be a changing game. Before we close, though, I'd like to shift gears and just switch to, a lot of people are very, very familiar with Epsilon Theory because it's one of the most popular blogs on the internet. But as far as what you guys do at Salient Partners, I think it's pretty diverse product offering. Fill us in quickly. What is it that you actually do in your day job, and what is offered at Salient?
No, thanks for that opportunity. So Salient manages about $14 billion. It started in Houston, Texas. Now we're in Houston and San Francisco. Our money management business is really focused on, I'll call it, and I don't mean this pejoratively, niche strategies, right? They're mostly expressed in mutual funds and 40 Act mutual funds. We also have separately managed accounts for institutional investors. But so, for example, we have what I think is a very strong real assets business, and that expresses itself with energy infrastructure, MLP, mutual funds. It expresses itself in certain places or areas of the REIT market. For example, a mutual fund that really focuses on REIT preferreds. So it's, again, I celebrate that word niche strategy rather than, you know, I don't mean that as a bad word at all. I love the niche strategies that Salient has because these are the sort of strategies where I think our active management, and these are actively management, it's where I think it can make a difference. So thanks for giving the opportunity to mention Salient there. It's a company I just couldn't be more proud of.
Well, it sounds like you're very well positioned to be prepared with cognizance of the fact that the tide is changing. So I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Stay tuned, everybody, as Kevin Muir will be joining Patrick Ceresna and I as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Now, Eric, we got a lot of positive feedback after bringing in several different guests and crude oil experts on the program in recent weeks to expand our oil market coverage. Now, since Dr. Hunt mentioned the bubble in the housing market, we asked Kevin Muir to join us on expanded coverage of the subject. Welcome aboard, Kevin.
Great to be with you guys.
Now, before we get into the topic, I wanted to just quickly talk about Ben Hunt's interview, Eric. I found it really interesting that he talked about all these negative impacts of the Fed shrinking their balance sheet. It's really becoming a hot topic nowadays. It's interesting to hear his insights. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, he's definitely, without a doubt, got exactly the right point, and I think he's making it at the right time. But I think it's really important to emphasize what George Soros calls reflexivity, which is that the Fed is making a bunch of statements now based on the way things are now. When the things that Ben Hunt is talking about start happening, is the Fed going to stay the course and say, hey, bailing out asset markets is not our job? Or are they going to go back to their old ways where at the first sign of difficulty, suddenly the Fed is reversing its position and jumping in and doing anything it takes to rescue the asset markets? There are so many moving parts here because the political imperatives have changed. It used to be that we could expect Janet Yellen to get tremendous pressure from Congress to rescue the economy at any sign of problems. These days, at least half of Congress would like to see the market crash as long as it can be blamed on Donald Trump. So, you know, anything could happen here. So I think we have to continue to watch this as a moving target and wait to see what the Fed policy reaction really is when things start to fall apart. Until then, we don't really know what their policy is going to be. But I agree with Ben Hunt that if they do what they say they're going to do now, it's going to create a headwind for markets moving forward.
Now, I also wanted to just point out, during the interview, you started to allude to a point about the systematic vulnerabilities that were created by the popularity of ETFs in the recent years. And I really thought that was valuable thing to talk about. And I think we need to understand more. Why don't you elaborate a little bit more on that point before we move on with Kevin?
Sure. The thing that I think it's really important for people to understand is that ETFs have changed the face of markets in the last 10 years. And what's happened is stock picking is no longer a very popular sport. People don't do it that much. They invest in sectors through ETFs. And there aren't a lot of individual investors. There aren't even among institutions. A lot of people are not picking stocks anymore. They're investing in sectors through ETFs. So what you have to realize is how the mechanics of ETFs work. When you sell ETF shares, the underlying shares have to get sold. And the mechanism for that is that market makers, as the ETF shares start to fall out of sync with the net asset value of the underlying components, they end up selling those underlying shares. So when the ETF shares are being sold, the underlying single stock issue shares have to get sold in order to facilitate that transaction. It has to happen that way. Question to ask yourself, and this is the $64 trillion question, is sold to whom if the face of the market has changed to where there aren't a lot of stock pickers anymore and there are not a lot of natural buyers for shares in individual issues? Who is going to buy those individual share issues from the market makers when the ETF selling forces them to sell? And if the answer is there really aren't that many natural buyers and it's only the real bottom pickers that are going to be willing to jump in and buy up those shares at a discount, that means it's going to be a pretty steep discount. So this is what I call the great ETF unwind. At some point when there's heavy pressure selling on ETFs, there's not going to be natural buyers there to buy the underlying shares from the market makers, and that's going to cause a very significant disparity where in order to keep up with the NAV of the ETF shares, there just has to be a fire sale of individual stock issues to a market that doesn't have natural buyers for them. And it could be a bloodbath and it could happen very quickly. So that's the thing you have to understand is that the mechanics of ETFs are such that there's going to be a push at some point to sell things when in a market where there's nobody waiting in line to buy them. And it could cause a real panic. But I want to shift gears now. And since we've got Kevin here, I think it's very important for us to understand that American hedge fund managers have a prejudice, and that prejudice is that because we lived through the U.S. housing bubble, which, by the way, was a very different market with securitized mortgages, not the same thing as they have in Canada, we assume it's going to go the same way. And one of the most fundamental assumptions that we make is that if there's going to be a popping of this housing bubble that clearly exists in Canada, that popping of the bubble presumably means that nominal prices go down dramatically. Kevin, you've got a view that the bubble can pop, but it's not necessarily nominal prices that collapse. Please elaborate.
In 2008, when the U.S. real estate rolled over, the U.S. dollar was the reserve currency, and actually still is the reserve currency. And when real estate caused the initial problems, it created a situation where liquidity started to run away. Credit started to be paid back, and credit was destroyed. And this actually caused the U.S. dollar to rally. The U.S. dollar to rally caused problems with less liquidity, which caused it fed upon itself, which caused more problems with the U.S. with the real estate. And next thing you knew, you had a situation where it was a self-reinforcing feedback loop. When I look at the Canadian situation, I think it's going to be much different. So if we get into trouble in Canada and the Canadian real estate market, what's going to happen is that Bank of Canada is going to come in and they're going to start to print. And they're going to print in a big way. And I don't know where that number is when they come in, whether they come in when it's down 10%, 15%, 20%, but they're going to print. And the other thing that you need to remember is the fact that although the Fed has done QE and the ECB did tons of QE and same with the Bank of Japan, you know, Canada never did that QE. So when people sit around and these hedge funds get all bearish on Canadian real estate, I think the part that they're missing is the fact that when it finally does turn, they're going to find that all of a sudden that the liquidity that's provided by Bank of Canada is going to cushion that fall. And what's going to happen is that, yes, Canadians in the value of their house will be going down in real terms, because what will be happening is the supply of Canadian dollars will be increasing, therefore sending it lower. So when, you know, Canadians will be coming more poor relative to the rest of the world, but the reality is that the nominal price will be cushioned. And so it won't be as bad, and the Bank of Canada is going to be there basically to slow down any cushion.
If I can just jump in there, a really good example of that, I guess you can relate to, is what happened with the bear market we had in stocks in Canada during the 2014-15 years when oil crashed. The Canadian stock market really went through this massive one-year pullback. And what ended up happening is that if you looked at, let's say, the MSCI Canadian Index in U.S. dollars, as it trades in New York, it was like a 40% plunge in the stock market. If you looked at something like Royal Bank shares as they trade in New York, they were down 40% from their highs. But because the Bank of Canada was so accommodative, the Canadian dollar dropped 20%. So when a Canadian looked at the value of their shares, of their mutual funds, or even of the value of, let's say, Royal Bank, I'm using as an example, the shares were only down 20%. It's because the nominal value, it kind of is hidden by the fact that the currency made that drop. So I guess you're suggesting here that that's exactly what we're going to see with the nominal prices of houses. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Now, I think in that case that you mentioned, it's actually, I kind of laugh at all the U.S. hedge funds that are, you know, been busy calling the bubble in Canadian real estate and have been patting themselves on the back for getting the Canadian dollar short over the past couple of years. Well, the reality is that the Canadian dollar went down because of oil, not because of the housing bubble. So we actually haven't had the pricking of the bubble yet in terms of the real estate. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what happens when we finally get the Canadian dollar going down for the reasons that many of these bears are forecasting. But yes, I completely agree. You're going to get a situation where Canadians will be more poor, but the nominal price of their house will go down a lot less than they expect. You know, I look around and I see these hedge funds, and it seems to be such a popular opinion. It kind of reminds me of the Irish proverb that was Jesse Livermore was fond of. And it's the proverb goes like, it says, the obvious rarely happens, the unexpected constantly occurs. I just, you know, if we did have a real estate crash that was exactly like 2008, it would be the first time that so many people have called it ahead of time. And I just don't see that happening. I think that there'll be a surprise.
And you know, what's interesting is how you say that is because everyone is calling this. Like I look at the headline that was just on Zero Hedge, and they have a big story saying the IMF rings the alarm on Canada's economy. And they're highlighting the fact that the IMF put out a report, and their big key point is that the main risk on the domestic side is a sharp correction in the housing market that impairs the bank balance sheets, triggers negative feedback loops in the economy, and increases the contagion effect on claims to the government and everything like that. If you see that story and you see that the Bank of International Settlements is coming out with this early warning about the stresses in the banking system, like everyone seems to be calling the top. And since when has there ever been a situation where everyone got it right? I mean, what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, well, tell me the last time that the BIS and the IMF actually called a crash before it occurred. It would be a unique situation if they actually did that. The other thing that's interesting that you mentioned, those the Canadian bank balance sheets. One of the things that also is different from the U.S. is the fact that in the U.S., much of the credit for the housing market was created by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and although they were implicitly guaranteed by the government, they were still private corporations. And when the U.S. housing crash occurred, there was still a lot of uncertainty regarding how those entities were going to be nationalized. And there was still a lot of problems and a lot of market disruptions caused by that transfer from the private to the public. What's different about Canada is the fact that it's already been nationalized. We have the Canadian Home Mortgage Corporation that basically does the same thing as Fannie and Freddie. And that's already owned by the government. So when the real estate correction occurs, and don't get me wrong, it's coming because, you know, we are so overextended and due for a correction. But when it occurs, and if it starts causing some stress, it's not going to cause stress in the private financial markets. Yes, it could cause some stress in the actual housing markets in terms of some over-leveraged buyers, but there won't be the mortgage, the securitization and the other mortgages that need to be sold at discounts, because the reality is that it's already sitting on the bank's balance sheet, or the government's balance sheet. And when a government gets in trouble, what's there going to be their solution? They're going to do what governments for years and decades and centuries and thousands of years have done in the past, and they're going to print. And so I think it's another example of how the U.S. template of the 2008 credit real estate crash is going to be different in Canada. Go ahead, Pat.
Hang on a second, guys, because I want to come back to Ben Hunt's question, which is, he said he doesn't know how to short this. I don't know how to short it either. I'm channeling an image of you two guys as the financial equivalent of the McKenzie brothers, our resident Canadians here, to give a perspective. Are you saying, Kevin, that the way to play this is short the Canadian dollar against the U.S. dollar? And if so, do you have to hedge that? Are there risks to where it could go the other way? I mean, what is the way? You're saying it's a different picture, and I think your arguments are excellent for why it's a different picture. But based on the understanding that you have of this picture, how do you short this thing?
Well, I completely agree. If you are a housing bear in Canada, I think a lot of guys are going out and they're trying to short, you know, the banks, or they're trying to pick the home capitals. I think you're much better off just going out and shorting the dollar, because at the end of the day, although we might get some moments of scariness, as soon as things get a little bit hairy, they are going to print. And when they print, it's going to cause a lot more of the supply of Canadian dollars to go up, and that's going to cause the value of the Canadian dollar to plummet. If you're bearish on Canadian real estate, then I think shorting the loonie is a great way to play it.
Now, Kev, I really want to, we can't have this conversation without having to throw this home capital thing into the conversation. Now, those of the listeners that are not familiar, home capital is a secondary mortgage lender in Canada, run into fraudulent problems, short-term funding problems. And back in 2014, a big U.S. investor, Mark Cohodes, came in and started shorting home capital, calling the big top of the real estate market in Canada. And he was right. He started shorting the thing up at $50 a share, and he rode it all the way down to like $6 a share, looking like a rock star. And then suddenly comes in the Oracle of Omaha. Buffett comes in riding on his white horse, and he comes in and takes a 40% stake, an almost 40% stake in home capital. And it reminds me so much of this Icahn versus Ackman style battle of Herbalife. And suddenly here we have Buffett against Cohodes. And the question is that who's going to win this battle? What's your opinion on this?
It's a tough one. And, you know, those are two great investors. And, you know, hats off to Cohodes that he wrote it down. I think that when I had written something down from 50 down to 5 or whatever the number was, and I was up 90%, I might have taken my money and just gone on to the next trade. But Cohodes was convinced that home capital was going to be a zero on the equity. And he's actually, I'm convinced that it's going to go into the debt layer, that there's that much problems there. I'm not sure that I agree in terms of his cynicism. And I'll tell you why. It's back to the Bank of Canada. I think that if we had a problem of that magnitude, then the Bank of Canada would be in there and would be providing liquidity. You know, one of the things about Cohodes is that he said that the Canadian real estate crash was going to be like the 2008 U.S. real estate crash on steroids and LSD. You know, this guy is really, really bearish on Canadian real estate. He's convinced that it's going to be worse than anything the Americans experienced. And I'm just not sure if I buy that. And, you know, a lot of people kind of say, you know, some things about, you know, Warren Buffett. He's not the nice old man that he plays on TV. You know, he's a shark. And I don't doubt that for a second. At the end of the day, he got himself a great deal on, you know, negotiating this, the home capital transaction that he did. But, you know, at the end of the day, he's a shark. And, he's not in this to help anybody out. He's in it to help himself out. And I think that if he thought that we were going to have a 2008 style crash, there's not a chance that he would be buying this or, you know, standing behind home capital the way he has.
Well, you know, I just wanted to jump in there and basically make the comment. Like, it's really interesting that it was Buffett that came in. You know, like, here we have six relatively well-capitalized major banks, all sorts of pensions with all-star for yield. Anyone could have stepped up to bat and bailed out this Home Capital. It's not exactly a huge company. And yet, you know, south of the border, here comes the Oracle of Omaha. And it's Buffett that comes in and bails it out. And it's like, why wouldn't our major banks or our pensions bail out this company? Why did it have to be an outsider like that? Would you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I definitely have an opinion. I think that they chose Buffett for his reputational bump that he was going to give them. You know, if you're sitting there and you're a small-time investor in the Home Capital GICs, and all of a sudden you see that Warren Buffett is invested in Home Capital, well, all of a sudden the mom and pops that are giving them $5, $10, $20,000, they can feel a little more assured. So I think that it was an astute play by Home Capital to, you know, to shore up the confidence in their company. So I think that there would have been plenty of other companies that would have given them the capital, but they chose Buffett for the reputational bump.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, it's the same kind of benefits that Wells Fargo enjoyed for many years until they had their own fraudulent problems on their end. But, you know, the one thing that Buffett does bring is there's a whole following of like zealot-like followers that whatever is good enough for Buffett is good enough for them. And that brings a wave of investors that are willing to take a risk on Home Capital because Buffett's there. So it definitely has this animal spirits kind of bump to it that is a big benefit.
And something else I want to add is, as Kevin said earlier, you know, it's really important to understand what happened in the U.S. in 2008 was not a housing crisis. It was a housing crisis that was the catalyst to trigger a credit crisis. And that credit crisis was mostly about securitization instruments that people didn't understand, the amount of leverage and risk that was embedded in collateralized debt obligations and these artificial ratings and the scandals that occurred within rating agencies in the U.S. to rate the bonds in those CDOs at a credit rating that they never deserved. Those things, there's no reason to expect those things to happen in Canada. In fact, they can't happen in Canada because you don't have the securitized mechanism that existed in the U.S. The part of this that's going to happen in Canada is the housing correction, which was the catalyst for the rest of the U.S. crisis. And we need to understand that the analogy, the parallel, ends there. And so it's really not the same ball of wax. Anyway, guys, we're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. Listeners, we do definitely need your help promoting the show, so please retweet our announcements, tell your friends, forward your research roundup emails, use our new donate button if you'd like to help us to defray our operating expenses and production costs. You can use our player embed to put a Macro Voices player on your own website, but most importantly, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. That statistic of how many registered users we have is the primary ingredient that Patrick needs in order to negotiate to get you the very best feature interview guests. The benefit to you of registration is that you receive our research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. We won't spam you with anything. We won't give your address to anybody else. All that we'll do is send you links so that you can download the chart books that go with our feature interviews, as well as the very best free content that our team of volunteer researchers could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what to expect in this week's research roundup.
Well, Eric, first off, I just wanted to thank Kevin for joining us today. Some really valuable insights that he was able to share with us. So in today's research roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview. You're going to find a link also to a few of Dr. Ben Hunt's recent articles so that you can just read some of his perspectives further beyond the interview. We also have the link to the recent second quarter update from Lacey Hunt. There's also an interesting article from Axel Merck, a guest that we had on recently on the show, and wrote a great piece talking about what's in store for the dollar, stocks, bonds, and gold. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that's it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, you can email us at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter. And we'll include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you've not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.